In case you missed it, Optimal Blue has announced the dates for its 2026 summit. Join us February 23rd to 25th at Talking Stick Resort and Conference Center in Scottsdale, Arizona, for a client-exclusive event packed with strategic insight and innovation. Attendees will gain early access to Optimal Blue's latest generative AI and automation tools, dive into expert-led sessions on pricing, compliance, and more, and experience hands-on demos of new capabilities. Plus, it's a chance to connect with capital markets pros, integration partners, and mortgage insiders, all while gaining actionable strategies to maximize profitability and sharpen your competitive edge. The Optimal Blue Summit, where proven mortgage expertise meets modern innovation to shape what's next. Early bird registration is now open at summit.optimalblue.com. Space is limited, so register today. Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Vice President of Hedging and Trading Client Services at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Hello, good afternoon, everybody. It is October 20th. It's fall. It's the first day of the MBA conference out in Las Vegas, so hope everybody's having a safe and productive trip out there. We're going to talk about a lot today. We're going to do a segment just on the market, what's going on right now. You know, we're entering week four of the government shutdown, and there's not a ton of data coming out as a result, but the Fed still has a meeting next week, so we'll talk about what that could look like. Meanwhile, a lot of this uncertainty between government shutdown, global tensions, trade war, we're getting lower rates in the mortgage industry. The OBMMI is approaching six, very close to around 6 1/8 right now. And the 10-year treasury is below 4%. So that's kind of a critical level we've been watching there as well. So 6% on the OBMMI, 4% on the 10-year is what we're is really where we want to. We want to be less than that, right? To keep up this little bit of a volume rally we have. And definitely seeing volume stay elevated. We're about 20, 30, even 40% over last year, depending on the day. And if you recall, last year was a pretty good rally as well, right around this time of the year. So again, seeing good volume there. You hate to root for global tension and issues that affect, you know, the labor sector, but we're getting the benefit of it here with interest rates. So yeah, let's check in with the gang here and see what's going on in the market. Okay, as promised, we've got the crew here to talk a little about what's going on in the world and in the market. You know, although there is very little, if any, data coming out during this government shutdown, there's still a Fed meeting next week. There's still a lot going on globally and you know, a lot of speakers coming up. So I wanted to just cover some stuff that you should be paying attention to over this next week and a half or however long it takes for the government shutdown to end, but also just generally what's going to impact rates here in the remainder of this month and going into the holiday season. Where should we start here, Alex? I mean, we're going to enter week four of the government shutdown here in a couple of days, right? So it's getting serious if it's not already pretty dire. I don't know. There's been some talk this week, even this morning, that there's some hope that we will come to some sort of agreement this week to reopen the government. But, you know, we'll believe that, I suppose, when we see it.
Yeah. White House economic advisor Hassett got on CNBC this morning, and he was saying that he sees the government shutdown ending by the end of this week or maybe early next week. He didn't quite say how he saw that light at the end of the tunnel, per se. He kind of just said that people are going to get sick of this and that one side or the other is going to capitulate here. You know, him, of course, claiming that that'll be the Democrats that'll come to the table on it, you know, but from what I saw of the clip and I watched the whole thing, he really didn't give a whole lot of details on how he saw this coming. Of course, he may have additional information behind closed doors that he wasn't allowed to, you know, say on national cable television. But yeah, it's, you know, we're in week three. It'll be four on Wednesday. I think the biggest thing here is what we talked about from the beginning, which was the fact that there are millions of federal workers who aren't receiving a paycheck right now, are furloughed, have, you know, throughout the entirety of this year, not known, you know, if their job is going to exist tomorrow or next week or next month. So, you know, this just comes on the back of a year of probably quite a bit of fear around their jobs and pay. And but I think the number one thing that a lot of people are focusing on is military pay. Obviously, the military is a massive contingent of federal workers. And there was a bill that failed in the Senate to get them paid during the shutdown period. So coming up, you know, this week or next week, depending on, you know, how they're paid in the military, you know, that they'll be without a full month of pay. So, and of course, they would get back pay once this all ends. But at the end of the day, people are still out in the economy spending money and they need money to pay their credit card bills and such. So,
yeah, it's we reported last week on the military thing that we thought we were hopeful. I think that was going to pass and that the military at least would get regular paychecks again, but that did get shot down early last week. So yeah, I mean, I've got some friends that work for the federal government and they're already talking about, you know, trying to take out a loan because they're at a point now where you go a month or two without a paycheck. That's obviously a huge deal. And you have to start looking at ways to float your, you know, your mortgage, your rent, your just general expenses, insurance and all that. So yeah, that's, I'm sure millions of frustrated folks out there that really want this thing to end. And people are losing their patience over it. I think everyone involved, the decision makers, are certainly aware of that. And hopefully it doesn't hasten a bad result, but hopefully it hastens a result here in the next week or so.
Right. And we were talking a little bit here before we started recording about, you know, what could be kind of the deadline here. And Hassett was saying that there's this November 1st, early November deadline. And we're kind of going back and forth. And James said that early sign up for next year's healthcare is the early lock-in period ends in early November. And so, you know, all this holdout on healthcare could be for naught if we get past this expiry date for the benefits that they're trying to preserve. The kind of the holding card that's holding everything up here, which again is those Obamacare, Affordable Care Act tax credits, is what's holding everything up. And, you know, if people are missing the sign up window to get their affordable health care, the leverage that the Democrats currently hold will no longer be in existence. And that could just lead everyone coming to the table and getting things funded.
Right. Or at the very least, it becomes another administrative hassle to kind of unravel that or figure that out after the fact, right? And figure out what comes of these deadlines when the government is still shut down.
Yeah, maybe what would happen if you did sign up and your premiums had gone up so significantly and then they managed to work some sort of deal out and now technically they should be lower, right? Would you be able to work your way out of that? Would any, you know, legal action be needed? There's kind of a big question mark there. So it's definitely a second hanging shoe.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, something to continue to keep an eye on. You know, it's a lot of uncertainty out there. And unfortunately fortunately, that's good for mortgage rates, right? So we're seeing, you know, the 10-year finally drop below 4%. I mentioned that earlier. And the OBMMI, so 30-year fixed conventional, is approaching that elusive 6% mark where we might actually see a 5 handle here soon. So kind of stinks the circumstances that cause these sort of rate moves, but we'll take it for now. I think certainly seeing a big pickup in volume as a result this week going into the MBA. We've seen like 30-40% increases over last year around this same time. And last year, if you remember around this time, we had a pretty good rally going in rates. We'll take it, but there's all these things that we need to keep an eye on as we go into the holiday season. Big one too is the Fed, right? We're going to have a Fed meeting next week. That's not part of the government that's shut down. And yeah, expecting a quarter point cut next week. So likely not going to get anything other than that. If we did, we'd certainly see a move in the market.
Yeah, it's currently CME Rate Watch Futures has 98% chance priced in that we're going to have two cuts in the two meetings this year. So almost a certainty that we're going to have two cuts. So we got next week, and then December 10th is the next meeting through the end of the year. It'll be super interesting to see, you know, how much they speak about the government shutdown, both in the, you know, the Fed announcement, and then kind of afterwards. It'll be interesting to kind of review what went into the Fed's logic in terms of the data they're looking at, since they are obviously missing some of the, you know, official numbers, employment numbers. We talked before we were on about, you know, some of the other numbers coming out there. James, you noted a couple places that are tracking their own employment numbers.
Yeah, the Dow published a number that's just around what they see employment at. And so you could look at that and use that as a figure for where was employment over September, October. And the one official number that they will have is, of course, CPI. They're, you know, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has called in a number of employees off furlough. Come in, we're going to get the CPI number out. It's kind of a critical number. We want to get the Fed to be lower in rates, so get the number out. It does look, projection right now is 3.1, which would be an increase from previously at 2.9. That said, I think we've been projecting that 3.1 most of the summer. So we could still be, you know, sitting pretty, 2.9. But it does feel, you know, maybe we've creeped up, maybe we've broken that 3% threshold. And I think that would have kind of an effect, seeing that number is out of the twos. It is creeping up and it has actually made it into a new handle, would be something that would probably stir a lot of people up.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be, I don't know, laser focus on that number, I suppose, because there's not a lot else coming out, because anything else that the Fed might use in terms of the labor market would be some sort of survey, like you said, from the Dow or another source that's not the BLS. So it'd be a little bit unorthodox, but they have to bring labor into that discussion somehow, right? And there may be other ways that they can peek into what that market looks like. And anecdotally, it's not good, right? Especially for folks who have just graduated from college, for instance, just continuing to see that kind of drag on the labor market, where we're seeing a resilient unemployment number, but again, you know, that's explained by the change, the transformation of the actual labor force right now, with things like immigration plummeting to negative numbers and just a general, I don't know, slowdown in hiring to the point where we probably would have expected zero jobs, maybe even a negative number this time around had we seen a number in October. All right. So what else is the Fed watching? I mean, we're all acutely aware of the trade war that seems to have been reignited over the past week and a half as well, right? And this all relates back to rates and relates to the Fed, right? Because you've got inflation, which is probably being propped up a little bit at this point by tariffs. And now we're in a pretty interesting standoff with the Chinese again over what tariffs and what, you know, price floors are going to look like here going into hopefully some sort of trade agreement with China.
Yeah, last week markets really got roiled by Trump seeming to kind of reignite the trade war. It kind of had, you know, been lulled over the summer into kind of this, you know, this is where we're at, and you know, the numbers were set, and we hadn't really heard too much on the trade war front for, as you know, longtime listeners of the show will know, for several months now. He really brought it all back with just, you know, a series of tweets. I think it was only one or two. Equity markets sold off 1.5% just on fears again of like a reignited trade war. He once again brought around the idea of just completely unsustainable and unrealistic tariffs that would amount to a complete trade embargo. And then within 48 hours, he kind of walked him back, said, you know, she's a good guy. Can't wait to see him in South Korea, and we'll get through this. But what I do think it highlights is it is a major priority for this administration to secure a rare earth mineral supply chain. We've seen them take stakes in domestic firms, or at least North American oriented firms, you know, some with, you know, some Canadian ownership, but for the most part with operations in or organized here in the United States. And then Trump is meeting with Australian Prime Minister today, and they are signing a deal as well to secure mining deals in Australia. So, you know, Australia is a key ally of ours in the Pacific theater, and having them on our side, not that they, I don't think we're, you know, swinging over towards, you know, into the Chinese orbit, but to have those mining rights and everything in order seems to, again, it's just what this administration would like to see is, you know, in, I think it's by 2040, you know, we're expecting to see, you know, a quadrupling of the rare earth needs for the economy.
Yeah, that's been a big bargaining chip this last couple of weeks, like you said, just the rare earth minerals, which China has a ton of that, and just, you know, because it does become more of a national security issue if we, you know, if those metals either become extremely expensive or even that we, you know, U.S. companies can't get their hands on them.
The price floors too is kind of, it's an interesting tactic, being that you know, whenever we talk about this or you hear it on the radio, China has all these rare earth minerals. They do. But so do Australia. The United States has a large deposit of these rare earth minerals. And of course, a friend of the administration, Greenland, has a lot of them as well. But there are other places that you could get these. However, China over the past 20, 30 years has basically competed other firms out of the market. They've been able to price these very, very low to stop other firms from really getting large enough, really having interest in opening the mines. So they've almost killed off a lot of the other competitors at a state level. And so by enforcing a floor, what the administration is doing, saying, hey, you can't buy these from anyone for lower than this price, that's going to enable, again, American firms, firms in South America and Australia to be more competitive and therefore more attractive to American buyers. And thus, you should be able to get more resources from a more diversified base.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's kind of the way oil has been over decades, right? The Middle East was able to pull oil out of the ground at such a low price and put it on the market at such a low price that it didn't make sense to pull oil out of the ground in the U.S., for instance, until gas was over $3.50, $4 a gallon, right? Just because of that sort of syndicate that controlled what those prices looked like. And it has come to light, or maybe the public is more aware now that China has put sort of an artificial super low price on those minerals so that no one else has really been encouraged to get into that business. So price floors mathematically make sense. So we'll see how that plays out.
Right. I definitely think there's parallels that can be drawn here from the domestic energy production sphere in America in like the 2010s that we saw, like you said, Jim, from, you know, $4 or $5 a gallon gasoline. It was a very unstable time throughout the Middle East during that time. So global oil prices, essentially a price floor was set by the market. And then what they're doing is, you know, instead of setting a price floor by the market, they'll simply just set one themselves. But it's the same game plan of, you know, we can build a domestic industry if the price is right.
I guess, meanwhile, that, you know, another thing that's come up over the past week that folks should definitely keep an eye on, especially in our industry, is we seem to be having maybe another mild panic around the regional banks and the general health of the banking system. So you may have seen some of the headlines recently about subprime car loans. A couple of companies went bankrupt recently that were held or at least invested in by some of the big banks, some of the big investment banks like Jefferies has made the news recently. Some people think there's a bubble there. And that's one of the concerns out there, is that we're going to have maybe an implosion, if you will, in some of these, starting with subprime car loans and then so on, right? There's been some talk about commercial real estate. There's fraud involved in some of these car loans too. So it's still a little bit gray. People are digging deeper into it, but we seem to have shrugged it off over the last few days. But sometimes where there's smoke, there's fire, right? I think Jamie Dimon made a euphemism about cockroaches. Like when you see one, there's probably a bunch. So anyway, something to watch, and has certainly moved the market on a few days over the past 2 weeks.
Back when Silicon Valley Bank was suffering about 4 years ago now, right? Right. So we're doing this every 4 years. It's a good little trend that we have. But back when Silicon Valley Bank went belly up, I remember people talking about zombie companies, that there was all this liquidity that came out during COVID. And there were a lot of companies that maybe shouldn't have survived that were able to. And since then, we've had this credit bubble, is probably the wrong word, but credit increase.
Glut.
Glut. People have been much more able to get their hands on credit and much more able to move. Ford was saying that they were going to be lowering, this is about a month ago, we might even have talked about it on the podcast, but Ford was going to lower their requirements of FICO score to get loans. So people have been kind of loosening the standards a little bit. There is definitely a conversation for, you know, hey, Americans have more credit card debt than ever. The average person has more debt. We've been taking on more credit. You can see whenever we've talked about the U.S. debt, states have, you know, $2 trillion, but companies have about 17. The only thing that's beating U.S. companies is the federal government itself. So there's a ton of credit out there that is a risk. But, you know, is J.P. Morgan and Wells Fargo the strongest companies in the world? Have they been making bad decisions? That's kind of hard to call out. seems it might just be handleable.
Yeah. Are they too big to fail too? Yeah. I mean, we came off of the highest savings rate in many decades during COVID. And now, as you said, we haven't talked about it recently very much, but now we are breaking records every day in terms of the amount of debt that borrowers have taken on in the U.S. So we do see that cycle over history. And some of this sounds familiar, right? You're talking about lowerings of standards, lots of credit out there. Not saying this is going to be 2007 again, but those were the similar circumstances back then and similar discussions that started with a couple of cockroaches, and the rest is in the history books, right? All right. Good discussion, gentlemen. A lot to keep an eye on, even though there's very few releases coming out right now. Watch the Fed next week. There's Fed speakers this week. Keep your eye on that as well. There's some testimony as well as some interviews on TV. Otherwise, everybody out at the NBA, hope you are having a productive week, and we will talk again next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, good stuff. Let's wrap this thing up. Thank you, James, Jeff, Alex. Great discussion today. A lot to think about, a lot to pay attention to as we go into the holidays. So that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning into Optimal Insights.
Is your technology vendor selling real solutions or just the idea of them? Too often, companies pitch big returns, offer free trials, and promise seamless automation, only to reveal during implementation that the tech doesn't actually exist. At Optimal Blue, we take a different approach. Our AI-powered automation is already live, already delivering, and already saving lenders real dollars. We show you exactly where the ROI comes from and how it reduces risk. No vague timelines, just proven technology that's working in production today. AI at Optimal Blue isn't just about delivering software. It's about empowering lenders to make smarter decisions, operate more efficiently, and stay ahead of the curve. Built around real capital markets challenges, informed by direct engagement with thousands of clients, and focused on delivering measurable value at no additional cost to clients. While others talk about AI, we're delivering it. Innovation that delivers for your bottom line. Learn more at optimalblue.com.